Welcome back, family. All right, so let me say up front that Brownstone loved the show Eve. So when we had the chance to interview a cast member of the show, we jumped at it. Little did we know that Reggie Gaskins, this week's guest, was an entertainment powerhouse. Reggie's done everything from writing, directing, producing, and acting. He stopped by the Brownstone to share his incredible story with us, and we are delighted to welcome to the family. If there's a Wikipedia page for Build Your Own Career Path, Reggie's picture is there, and he's signing autographs at the end. So check this one out, and don't forget to let us know what you think. Hit us on viewfromthestoop.com, Facebook, or Instagram. Tell us who you'd like us to interview or re-interview, and check out the Brownstone Media Group Top 10 list on Spotify. So this is a good one, family. Let's go. First of all, like I said, thank you for doing this. And please, for those who don't know, I don't know, living under a rock, having watched television or film in the last 20 years, please tell everybody who you are, what you do, and how you got to where you are.
My name is Reggie Gaskins, native of Philadelphia. I'm an actor, writer, and director, now living in Los Angeles. And two or three of the biggest things I'm known for is Friday After Next. I was Officer B. Dix and Eve. I was Janie's husband. Curb Your Enthusiasm, I was on there. And Restraining Order. I was this movie I was in with Robin Givens, James Avery, and Boucher Wright and Sean Blakemore.
I was going to wait and ask you about Curb Your Enthusiasm, but I've seen you in a lot of things over the year, and I swear to God, the funniest thing I've ever seen is the look that you give, Larry David, when you say, so you think all black people look the same on Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah. It was fun.
It was just a moment, but that look, oh my God, I was crying. I think I rewound that thing like four or five times and told people about it.
Thank you, man. Yeah, it was a lot of fun doing that. And, you know, Larry is a comedic genius, man. I mean, all that's unscripted, you know. And none of that's scripted. So it worked out really, really good. We had a lot of fun doing it.
So every moment that's unscripted or every moment doesn't just form perfectly. How long did it take for you to get that one moment done?
Oh, man, that was like one of the first takes.
Oh, okay.
You know, that was one of the first takes. Had a, you know, study sketch and improv acting. You know, a lot of great moments happened, you know, the very first time out because you never know what's going to happen.
Okay.
And then each moment after that is always different. So, you know, that particular one we got kind of right off the bat.
If you haven't seen that, look it up. It's probably on YouTube. That look that he gives Larry David, I guarantee you've given that look to somebody in your life. It was so real and funny.
I sure have.
So I want to go back. You grew up in Philly. And at what moment did you decide that you needed to share your gift with the world?
When all my grades in college was coming up D's. No, this college thing ain't working. I might as well do something else.
Let me switch up.
Right. No, actually, for me, so I was raised in Philly. My mom was a teacher. Both my mom and my dad were both educators. They were both teachers in the school system. And, you know, back in the day, they were like, in order to make money or to have a successful living, you know, she was like, you should major in business, law, or medicine. Because making money in other areas, you know, outside of you know, blue collar work or whatever the case is, it just didn't seem to be a smart thing to do.
Uh-huh.
So, but I was always, I wasn't a talkative kid. I was relatively shy, but I was around kids who were a little bit more shy than me sometimes. So I would be the one to initiate stuff because I was like, I want to have fun. And I was always kind of the one that would be in the forefront, starting the conversation. If we go to party, starting everybody dancing, you know, if we're out, starting a conversation, if we're out at lunch or whatever the case is. So even though my major in college was My first major was business. Then I transitioned over into accounting, then psychology. Even though those were my majors, I was kind of militant in college as well. In terms of Black history.
Mm-hmm.
But the first time, just having that type of personality, someone had asked me to be in a play in college. And I was like, yeah, sure. No big deal. There was no fear because I didn't look at it as being in front of people for the first time talking. I just was like, they need help. I looked at it more that way. And man, when I got on stage, I just started having fun kind of in this character, doing what I was doing. And they were like, yo, you need to act. But I never took it seriously. I never took it to heart. Long story short, came home at the end of my senior year, and before going back to college, I was working and playing basketball in Philly. And I was like, it's got to be more life than just working and playing ball. And I walked by Freedom Theater, which was close to my house. And I remember, I walked by it all the time. But for whatever reason, this particular day, I just stopped and I heard people on there singing and just a myriad of things, singing, acting, music, where I guess people were dancing. And I'm standing outside like I'm wondering what they're doing there. And this elderly gentleman was like, if you're going to stand out here, you can't stand at the front of the building. You either walk on or you come inside, but you're not going to be standing in front of this building. We're not getting robbed. I'm like, I'm not here to rob you, dude. First of all, it's a theater. What am I going to steal? A fake tree?
Right.
So I went inside and signed up for a class and have been acting ever since.
So the theater is not an easy thing to learn. It's all about blocking and where to stand, when to come in, how to project your voice. How long did it take you to go from zero to full-fledged?
In terms of full-fledged, having the desire to do theater, first day.
Okay.
Getting good at it, I'm still working at getting good at theater. That is the pinnacle for any actor,
mm-hmm.
To be able to go on stage, develop a character, remember your lines, work with other actors who have to know their lines, know your blocking, get off stage, get in the wardrobe, get back on stage. It's the pinnacle. And I think any actor that believes they've mastered the art of theater acting would be deluding themselves, because you learn with every play.
Mm-hmm.
And every play I did, I learned something different. And it's interesting because I, Philly is kind of a rough town. So I grew up not having a lot of fear.
Mm-hmm.
And many things didn't scare me. And theater was the first thing that I tackled that was like, yo, this is scary, and I'm competitive. Like, I wanted to do good. I played basketball in high school,
mm-hmm.
and a little bit in college. And I was like, I want to be good at this, And there are a lot of actors who just pick up the art of theater acting and they run with it. They're a beast at it. And it's like, wow, that's what I want to be. And how do you do that? And everybody's looking at me and, oh my gosh, did I put my pants on before my underwear? My underwear showing, what is everybody looking at? So, but I'm thankful to have had a theater career in Philly. I did theater in Philly and New York before coming to L.A.
So you mentioned moving to L.A. You were already on the East Coast. Philly's kind of a perfect city to move up and down the coast from. Was there ever the thought to just move to New York and make a go of it there, or was L.A. always the goal?
I never wanted to come to L.A.
Okay.
I was good with doing theater in Philly and New York.
Okay.
And I was like, I just want to learn. And New York was kind of New York can be intimidating. Theater actors in New York, they're on a whole nother level. And so I was like, I kind of want to learn here. But the plays that I was doing at Freedom, you know, the first few initial plays that I was doing, a lot of August Wilson plays, you know, Two Trains Running, Piano Lesson, Fences. Then you had, you know, other plays, Funny House of the Negro, Colored Museum, Mighty Gents, just, you know, a lot of plays were kind of period pieces. And I went to college, and I was arrogant from the standpoint that I went to college to learn so that I could function in society. And I felt that doing these period plays wasn't allowing African Americans to be seen as learning individuals. Hmm. It's like, I don't want to spend my whole career on stage. Yes, sir, bosses. Anything else I could do for you, sir? You know? I don't want to be saying that every month, you know, for 6 weeks. No, you know. Stuck in my brain. Can right. I get some large fries and a big snack?
Yeah, I was about to say, you might slip up and do it at McDonald's and have some explaining to do.
Yeah, you know, it's like, I don't want to do that. So I began to write plays that kind of touched on things I dealt with growing up, you know, and one of the things that was in Philly that was big, you know, the JBM, which was the Junior Black Mafia, and, you know, a lot of drug dealers in every neighborhood, every city around the country.
Mm-hmm.
But I wrote a play called We Can Do This. And it was basically, I remember when I came home from college, first I'm thankful for the people that in my neighborhood, because coming up, you know, a lot of old heads was like, Reggie, you know, he got a career because I could play ball. So they wouldn't let me really get mixed up in no street stuff. And my mom would let me get mixed up in street stuff. So I was fortunate to be able to, you know, play ball and run track without having the distraction of, you know, selling drugs on the block or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I came home, you know, the old his neighborhood was like, yo, you know, one of us made it or whatever the case is. And there were some people like, oh, this dude is bougie. And, you know, because that's kind of how it was, you know, when certain people, like, if your whole neighborhood is an environment that's entrenched in, you know, whatever drugs or just hood life or whatever. Five people make it out, 95 stay in. Those five that come back, they could be perceived as sellouts, or you left us, or you think you're better than us, or anything like that.
Right.
So I wrote a play called We Can Do This, which was about a guy who had went to college and came back from college and found out that his best friend, who was a genius, was now a big-time drug dealer. He was like, yo, you could be, you know, like one of the greatest mathematicians at NASA somewhere if you stop selling drugs and use your mind for something better. And he was like, I would do something like that if it wasn't bougie black people like you that would look down on me and judge me and not even give me an opportunity, because all you see is me as a black man who sells drugs. So I don't want to be in that barn. So the whole play, which was called We Can Do This, was we can bridge the gap and unite as a people to better ourselves. So all the gangsters and all the bougie, you know, black folk, we can come together and be one and just be one people. And that's how I got into the writing and how I got myself out of doing, yes, I'm also playing.
So what was the reception for your first work?
People really love the play. The play did really, really well. And the show's only run for like a weekend, like two shows, and ended up running it for like a month or two.
Okay.
So, you know, I was thankful for that. And that kind of propelled me into writing. And I took a love for writing, you know, after writing this play. And creating an opportunity for myself to play characters that I otherwise, you know, might not have got cast for.
Mm-hmm.
And once that happened, you know, I began to write another play called Love, Drugs, and More, which was kind of like part two of We Can Do This. And this was my ode to having a war on drugs, but it was a love story. And then I wrote another play for Father and Son. And two of my actors that were in my plays got the acting bug, and they moved to L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the ones who began to talk me into moving to L.A. And both phenomenal actors, Keith Burke and Keanu Levin, great actors. You know, they ain't no joke. But I didn't want to move. I was like, I'd rather do plays than fill in New York. I don't want to be in L.A. Everybody in L.A. wants to be a movie star, a TV star. I don't want to be no star. I just want to tell stories.
Right.
And, but at the encouraging, you know, I was like, all right, let me go, let me see. And, moved out here. And then getting out here, I fell in love with television and film and have only done like maybe four plays since being in LA. All I really do is television and film because then I found a love for that medium. And kind of went after that as hard as I went after acting.
So once you were out in L.A., what would you consider the next big moment, the next break, and what would be your career?
Writing my very first feature film, which was called Restraining Order.
Okay.
And I used to love legal shows and playing characters, playing a lawyer. That was kind of my niche. And I wrote a film called Restraining Order where I played a lawyer who was retiring from law. And I had a good life, a good wife, you know. And my friend, who was a female friend, she married someone that he was a hard worker. You know, he worked at a construction plant, but he loved her. But she wanted the life. She wanted to be the wife of a lawyer. And because she had these feelings for another man, her husband couldn't take it. And he was starting to flip out. So she was like, I got to get a restraining order against this dude.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, what's making her feel this way? And she was like, oh, it's that dude. All right. So if this dude is trying to take my wife, I'm going to take his wife. And it was a great film. And the reason why it was the biggest moment for me, that film got me my nominated for NAACP Image Award for Outstanding Writing of a Feature Film.
That had to be a surreal moment.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was. And I was up against Akilah and the Bee and Tyler Perry's movie, his second one. I can't remember it. But his movie at the time in 06 and two other movies, but I was up against mainstream movies and I was nominated.
So how do they notify you?
When your film is, you know, submitted and selected, they just, you know, call you or email you, whatever the case is, and let you know you've been nominated for whatever category.
Mm.
And I was nominated for Outstanding Writing of a Feature Film.
So you're just chilling and out of nowhere, email comes in real nonchalant. That changes everything.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was like, wow. You know, and just to have an opportunity, you know, you go to the luncheon, the nomination luncheon, and I had, you know, done background work as an actor and some other work as an actor, you know, around some celebrities or whatever, but, you know, still trying to make my way up the ladder, whatever the case is, and here to be in a forum where I am, quote unquote, on their level. You know, I'm nominated just like you nominated, you know. So instead of being on set, it's like, can you get me some water? No, can you get me some water?
You were just ordering waters for no reason at that point.
You know, exactly. So it was, you know, it was a great moment. I was very, very thankful. And, you know, the team that I had working with me, my writing team at the time, Heather Dawn and Paula, you know, it was like, wow, this is, you know, what it's about. Because for me, playing high school ball and then a little bit of college ball, but I remember my coach saying, if you're not on the team to win the championship, what's the point? And so I try to approach everything like that. If I'm not writing to win, you know, outstanding writing or outstanding acting or whatever, what's the point? So it was like great, like wow, like it was mission accomplished.
Mm-hmm. So from there,
it was a great moment for me.
From there, mm-hmm. I think the next time I really saw you was in Eve, and it was such a perfect balance to the craziness of I forget the young lady's name who played your wife.
My character was Marty.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife was Eve. I mean, Janie.
Right. How did that come about?
Yeah.
It seems like actors work forever to get that type of featured role. Was it all of a sudden, or was it the product of a lot of hard work?
It was a product of a lot of hard work, because, you know, I had to go through the audition process. But even before the audition process, it was preparing myself as an actor to kind of be considered for all roles, basically.
Uh-huh.
Because you can get in LA, you can get caught up in the whirlwind. Everybody from everywhere comes to LA to make it as an actor, you know what I mean? And with that being the case, actress was Natalie Dassel. But everybody comes to LA to be an actor, you know, actor, actress, or whatever the case is. So you have to figure out, what can I do to stand out? Because what I learned, it's not always about talent. It's mm-hmm. a gang of talented people out here. It's just, what can you do to stand out in this character? And I attribute that booking, and all my bookings, to be honest with you, but I attribute it to favor. I just attribute it to God having favor on me and having favor on the work that I put in to be prepared, you know, studying in different classes and putting yourself in positions. I tell people, don't have fear. You know, people live one of two things. They either live their fears or live their dreams. And if you live your fear, you're not putting yourself in an uncomfortable position to ultimately feel comfortable in, because you'd rather stay in your comfort zone. And I would always push myself outside of my comfort zone so that when I was put in a situation like the audition for Eve, which is high pressure and can be uncomfortable,
mm-hmm.
okay, I'm used to this. I'm used to this. You know, I'm used to being outside of my comfort zone, and I know how to function in it. And when I got the call that I had booked it, I remember I had just probably lived in a one-bedroom apartment in the hood of L.A., basically. And I had just parked and was pretty much having a good day. I was like, I ain't really got no money, but I'm happy.
Mm-hmm.
Just came from the gym from playing ball, you know. I won. My team won, you know. I'm sitting ready to go home and watch the rerun of the Cosby Show or something. I'm okay. And my agent called me, and he said, Reg, we have some news for you. And I'm like, oh, okay, I'm thinking it's another audition. And he said, you booked it. I was like, I booked what? He said, you booked Eve. You know, man, I think everybody in my neighborhood right at that moment knew, like, you know, what happened? What's going on outside? There's a riot outside, you know.
Right.
And I was like, wow, you know. And it just so happened, like, my first show of that magnitude from with somebody who's from Philly. You know, I was like, wow, this is crazy. And I'm with, you know, Jason George, who was, you know, pretty big at the time, coming off the Barbershop movie and everything. So I was like, let's go. Let's do this. And I was just, you know, I was ecstatic. I was like, let's go. I was ready.
So during that time, were you still working on your own stuff as well, or you focused fully in on the Eve project?
I focused on Eve, but no, I kept writing. I kept writing my films, my stories, and I began to do stand up.
Okay.
Which was something that I did not want to do. My manager was like, "You're hilarious. You should do stand up." And I'm like, "I don't want to do stand up. I just don't want to do it." You know.
That's a whole sketch. That's a whole other acting muscle, if you will. And you had to develop that. How hard was it to just jump and do that?
Oh, my God. Okay. Because I'm an actor, jumping on stage and doing it wasn't an issue.
Okay.
That wasn't my problem. Having something to talk about and structure it in a format that's funny, that was an issue. You know, because that's the beast and the reality of stand-up, that these comedians, man, it's much respect to them because they understand the pulse of an audience. They understand the pulse of themselves, like their voice, their point of view. And they have an understanding of how to tell their story in a way where your brain can understand the introduction of the story, the meat of the story, and the joke of the story so that everybody laughs. You know, like there are some people that can tell a story and, you know, and they're in the house and they got everybody cracking up. As soon as you put them on stage, they can't tell the story no more because it's a whole nother gift. It's a whole nother art. And then just constantly being able to talk about anything and make it funny. A friend of mine just was talking to me today. He's like, "Man, you need to be on stage more and you know, tell these jokes and blah, blah, blah." And I was like, "I don't want to do it." You know, for me, I love acting. Give me a script. You know what I mean? Give me a script. Give me a scene partner. Let's go, you know, whatever it is. And like, I don't mind stand up. I don't have the discipline, though, that stand up comedians have because they're writing jokes every day. And for me as a writer, when I'm writing stories, I'm writing a comedic story that has a lot of moving parts, a lot of moving elements. Okay, this character says that character says that. And then they get up and they move to the kitchen and this happens and then that happens. Where on stage, the only moving part you got is you and that mic. So I'm thankful, you know, that I just posted something more on Instagram from me doing stand-up from a class I did with David Arnold. And at his showcase, and you know, people found it funny. You know, they're like, "You're funny. You should do it more." But I just learned that it's not my passion, and I don't want to be disrespectful to the craft of stand-up by exploiting it just to do it. And if I don't have the passion behind it,
right?
You know what I mean? And I'm older now. I don't want to be in the club midnight waiting to get on the mic. You know? I don't want to do all that. I got to go to the bathroom.
I'm tired.
Yeah, right. It's my time to go sit on the throne. I'm here in some comedy club. I can't even use y'all bathroom because there's 20 other people in there. And I got to figure out when am I going to get a chance to tell a joke. So by the time I do get on stage, I'm too frustrated. Come to the stage. No, I ain't gonna be here long because I got to go poop. Yes, I said poop. I'm 63 years old. Poop. That's what I said. How old is he? Did he just say poop? Who is this for? Only my grandfather says poop. Me and your grandfather went to school together, okay? How about that? But you look so young. Black don't crack, god dang it. Now you got some, you got something like a bite, you got some Charmin.
Hey, look, every black person age freezes somewhere around 27 and doesn't start again till like 70 something.
Exactly.
We are all of indeterminate age. I think I saw Angela Bassett the other day. She still looked like she's 37. Who knows how old she is?
Man, Angela Bassett, I'm a friend of mine. Angela Bassett and a friend of mine, great actress. Me and her did four films together. Mari Morrow.
Mm-hmm.
Mari Morrow is the female Benjamin Button.
Okay.
This chick ain't aged since her junior prom. Goodness, I don't know how old Mari is.
I saw a video of Janet Jackson. She got to be closer to 60 to 50, and she was on there dancing to Cardi B. I said, Lord, I can't even bend over some days. I don't know what's going on.
Exactly, you know. And when women age, they can do that with their bodies. Men, we can't do that.
Mm-mm.
You know what I mean? Ain't going to be no MC Hammer review next month, and he's still doing that stuff. It ain't going to happen.
Well, too, because I'm not going to that show at all. So he can show up and do it if he want to. I got the tapes. I'm good.
Exactly.
Let me ask you this. Your career, you've worn, let's say, a million hats. Comedian, director, playwright, writer for film and television. That type of diversity isn't just out of nowhere. How did you build that skill set?
Grinding and keeping myself competitive in the field. And what I mean by that is I didn't go to school. I didn't go to film school, you know. So what I would do is would be film study. I'd watch television and start to learn and understand the structure of a television show, the structure of a film, and how they do it, you know. And then would take, you know, little extended education classes here and there. Like I took an class at USC, and then different, you know, little classes like an acting class or writer's workshop or something like that. And then I would just study, like in the first 5 minutes of every film, what's a consistent thing that every film has, or what's a consistent thing in the first 20 minutes or a television show. And that was my film study. And then it was like, okay, I have an idea of how it works. And now I have to take the knowledge that I've gained from being a sponge and not only become good at it, but I have to be competitive at it. So I want to be competitive as if I did go to film school. And I remember crying out to God one day. I was like, Lord, I just want to learn, and I can't afford none of these goddamn classes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, investing in yourself in this business, it's an investment. It is a huge investment. You know, from classes to headshots to your clothes, you know, when you're going on auditions, to how you eat, how you take care of your body. It's not everybody thinks, you know, you got to be skinny and all that stuff. It's not about that. It's about taking care of yourself so that you're not sick while you're working, because you're talking about 14-hour days when you're on set. So you're fighting against exhaustion. You're fighting against catching a cold. And a lot of that has to do with how you eat, how you take care of yourself. With all of that, I tried to learn as much as I could to stay as competitive as I could, so that if I write something or direct something or produce something, it comes out where it's like, okay, he knows what he's doing. And, you know, I'm still learning because I'm competing against people that went to school. And then the type of stories I write, you know, I don't I don't like to write ghetto stuff.
Mm-hmm.
To be just, you know. But there's a niche for everything. So the writer who does, that's, you know, some people would judge writing, like, oh, he just writes ghetto stuff. Well, if that's his niche and he's good at it, why are you judging him? He
right.
found something he's good at and he's doing it. Just because you don't like it don't mean it's wrong. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, you know, there's just certain things that, for me, I don't like to write. You know, and I remember a friend of mine said, if you want to make some money, you need to write something ghetto. I was like, I'm not doing it. I don't want to. You know, I had a television exec tell me for a television show that I pitched that it wasn't black enough.
Wait.
It was too educated, what they told me.
So he told you, a black man, that you didn't write something black enough.
Uh-huh.
With a straight face, yep. He said that.
Oh, yeah. He was very serious. He wasn't playing around. He was like, this is the truth. You know, he said, if you want to sell the show, you know, in our opinion, it's not black enough. It's too educated.
And you said, thank you.
And
I'm moving on.
Yeah, I'm like, okay, well, now I know where you're coming from. I appreciate somebody let you know who they are. Believe them.
Right.
You know, so I'm like, I understand who you are and what you're about. And I'm not playing them games. So, I move on and you know, did my thing in the manner in which I want to do it and not succumbing to doing things their way in the way they would want us to do it, you know. And now, thankfully, times have changed where I think some doors are opening, you know. I personally don't think enough, in my humble opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's some, but I don't think it's enough. But, you know, any level of progress, you know, you got to look at that and like, hey, that's progress.
Mm-hmm.
May not be at the level of progress we want or to the extent, but it is some progress. And I just want to continue down that vein. But it's very frustrating. It's very frustrating because I think the industry has brainwashed us into believing that society will only accept certain levels of entertainment from African Americans. And if you try to go outside that level, African Americans and people abroad or whatever, I don't want to support that because it doesn't fall into what, you know, almost what society has us to believe it should fall into.
Mm-hmm.
And then some stuff just ain't that good. Like, I'm trying to get a message across. Yeah, but this ain't good. Ain't nothing funny about this, or interesting, or intelligent. You know, so. Yeah, so it's a constant hustle.
I want to ask you about the web series that you've done. Did you see that as an avenue to have complete creative control, or that was just the next evolution of where you were headed?
For me, a web series was a means to an end to get financing for my film. I was like, if I can make a web series. And that's how my film Restraining Order started out as a short, and my film The Lying Truth started out as a web series.
Okay.
And I made both to garner interest and people with money into turning them into feature films. And they both got turned into feature films. And I won Best Picture Awards and got nominated for an NAACP Image Award from creating a web series for the purpose of turning it into a feature film.
So when did you start your production company? Was that something that was in place before you got to Hollywood or LA? Or was that something that also came along with the web series and things like that?
No, when I started writing short films, I created, you know, my company, which I created back in Philly,
because
I wanted to have a name for, you know, the company that was producing you know, whatever my play would be, you know, like the play by, you know, and my company was One to Grow on Films. Because I always wanted to write films with a message that people could grow on.
Mm.
And that's how I came up with the name for my company, One to Grow On. Like, this is One to Grow On.
Mm.
That we as people and, you know, as individuals, you can learn from this.
So
try to write.
So what's next?
Something for that purpose. Well, my film right now that's out is The Lying Truth, mm-hmm. which is on Amazon Prime. So I'm asking everyone, please go and rent or buy. You know, even though you can watch it for free, the renting of it or buying it, you know, benefits us all. But I am, you know, needing to get it for free, which is on Prime.
Mm.
And I'm also in the process of trying to raise money to shoot my next feature film, which is a faith-based project entitled What's the Point?
Okay.
This is a great, great movie. Oh, this is a great movie. And I got to figure out a way to make this movie.
Mm.
I have to. The log line of the film is there's no testimony without a test.
Mm.
And that in and of itself is why the film has to be made.
So if anyone wanted to contribute to help out, how would they get in contact with you?
They can email me. My email is reggiesfilms@gmail.com. And through social media,
you know,
a lot of people have contacted me through social media for various things. But I need a serious investor, someone mm-hmm. that understands and recognizes the power of the purchasing dollar
mm-hmm.
of our community, the African-American community, and the power of faith-based films, you know. And this isn't a film written for the purpose of making money. It's from a business standpoint, it's the film business. So let me be very clear. The purpose of anything that's entertainment-based is for the purpose of making money
mm-hmm.
because it's a film business. But the film, as all films do, transcends or adds to that purpose by it being a film that will not only entertain and educate its audience, but give its audience hope and encouragement. Same with War Room, same with Shawshank Redemption, same with Scarface. As crazy it may sound, Scarface is a film, as violent as it is, for generations gave people hope.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if this dude came here and was able to do all this, mm-hmm. even though it's not even a true story, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? And amass this, if I can take his level of tenacity and hustle and utilize it for good to get the same outcome, you know, I mean, it's films inspire people.
Right.
And, you know, from a business standpoint, War Room, great faith-based film, no stars in it, you know. Did you see War Room?
I didn't see War Room. I've heard so much about it. I've actually seen the next film that T.C. Stallings did that's actually about to come out, A Question of Faith. And
okay. I saw that one also.
Yeah, that one was powerful as well.
Right. War Room, no stars, no big budget, no big fanfare. Made it for $3 million, which people think that's trumped up. Some people think the film was only made for $500,000 to $1 million, right? Mm-hmm. Made $67 million.
Right.
You know what I mean?
It shows that the audience is there.
Exactly. Another film called God's Not Dead.
Right.
I know 9 people and 2 puppies that saw this film. you know, made like almost $50 million. The business aspect is, if you know that there is an audience for your film, and there typically always is, and you believe that the filmmaker has the ability to garner an audience to go see this film, then the smart business people say, I'm going to put my money into the smart film. And boom. And that's what my film Must Have Point is. I just believe it's a very, very smart investment for a filmmaker. I mean, for an investor.
So is there anything that you're currently filming?
I'm doing a film right now called Perfectly Single. It's a romantic comedy, mm-hmm. and I'm one of the actors in it, and it's a good comedic role. I'm opposite Erica Hubbard, so
okay.
look out for that coming out.
That's a family member right there. We had the pleasure of having Erica on the show. A wonderful person. Wonderful.
Yes. Yeah. They're some good people. So that's the next thing to kind of look out for me.
Where do you see yourself in 5 years from now? What does the future hold for Reggie Gaskins?
5 years from now, I would like to be at a place where my next three films have been in theaters with rave reviews. Mm-hmm. Within that 5 years, I would have been nominated for a Golden Globe nomination, either for Best Acting, Writing, or Directing.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. I'm nominated for Best Acting, Writing, or Directing within that 5 years, and I would be on season 2 or 3 of my television series. I want to develop my point. My film that's out now called The Lying Truth. I'm going to develop that as a television series, a one-hour mm-hmm. drama, and I have a sitcom that I'm going to develop. The sitcom is right now called Child Support. You know, that'll probably change. Mm. But that, I believe, would be a great half hour. it's a funny sitcom. so in 5 years, that's where I want my career to be. And family-wise, I just want my family with me and around me.
Mm.
Everybody happy and healthy, laughing and enjoying the fruits of our labor.
Amen. Look, once again, I really appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule. Obviously a busy man, obviously got so many irons in the fire. His name's on everything. If you haven't seen him, you've seen him. You probably just didn't know he was there. He's been in everything. So please feel free to swing by. Always know that, you know, you have a home here if you want to talk about something. If you just want to talk sports, swing by, we'll do that. But you're always welcome.
We can do that.
And welcome to
Thank
the family.
You. I'm talking about my Eagles and my Fixes. It's all about the Eagles. 1 second left. Booyah!
As a Redskins and Wizards fan, he doesn't know what he's talking about, people. But it's okay. We still love him. We still love him. Yeah, you know, garbage, dirty birds.
The dirty birds. Have the Redskins number.
All right, they got us week 1, full disclosure, but that's okay. Kirk Cousins doesn't start playing until week 4 anyway. They got us a few years back, tricked us into taking McNabb, but that's okay. We'll never forgive him for that.
I'm sure y'all won't.
Oh, man. Like, don't hold the Eagles fan against them. At least he's not a Cowboys fan.
No, never.
Yeah. No, nobody likes those dudes. Nobody. But listen, man, like I said, please come back again. We love having you here. Check him out. Tell everybody your Instagram so that they can follow you on there.
So on Instagram, it's Reggie Gaskins. On Twitter and Facebook, Reggie Gaskins. So please check me out, and please, 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 please go to Amazon.com or Amazon Prime and watch The Lying Truth. And write me on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter and let me know your thoughts on the film.
Don't just watch it. Rent it. Buy it. Rent it and buy it.
Buy it.
Twice.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.